White Network presents the International Jew Study Hour. Reading and commentary on Henry Ford's great classic about Jewish power in America.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to episode 25 of the International Jew Study Hour. On this rather dark evening of December 13th, 2012, I'm Carolyn Yeager with co-host Hanning Scott. Hi,
Hello.
Hanning.
Hello.
Yeah, you're there. So this means that we have been doing this for 25 weeks now because we haven't missed a week, and we don't plan on missing
almost half a year.
Yeah, that's right. And we're only one quarter of the way through. Or we will be when we end tonight's show. Yeah. So we'll see how long people can hang on. I know that I've read some of the chapters that are further up, you know, and I don't know how far along they were, but pretty far from here. And they were really interesting. So I'm sure I'll stay interested in it. And I was going to say that... What was I going to say? I forgot what I was going to say. But anyway, I said it was kind of dark, very dark. We're in the winter solstice time, the shortest days of the year. Shortest days, longest nights. So how is it there where you are in?
I'm sitting here in a jacket.
You don't heat your house real a lot, right?
Oh, I actually can't afford it.
You shouldn't admit that. You say, I'm rich, but I prefer cool temperatures. I prefer cool temperatures.
Yes, I'm a Nietzschean Ubermensch, and I don't, I don't wear socks.
Yeah. Very good. You don't?
Whatever.
I wear like 3 pairs of socks, you know, at this time of year. But then I don't have any shoes on. Well, that's the way. We don't want to tell people too much about our home life, or then we might lose some of the intrigue of listening to us on this program. Well, another thing I want to say is that yesterday was 12-12-12. You know, I really get into these kinds of numbers, dates, and so on. And wasn't this, I want to know what kind of a day it was for you, or did you notice anything that happened on the larger stage of the world that might point to something momentous in the future? And is this the Mayan? I forgot already. They quit talking about this. Wasn't it December 12th? 2012 or something like that, when the world is going to come to an end?
I think they said 21. I mean, 12, I never 21. Followed that, but oh. I saw...
It was 2012, though, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, 2012. I think so. That was back in the 80s, you know, it was like, 2012. That seems so far away that anything could happen. That was believable, you know? But as it gets closer, you don't hear anything about it because obviously it's not going to happen. Go ahead.
Probably not.
I don't think so.
I don't see any physical process, beginning here. You know, if the Earth were going to fall apart, I would expect to see some crevices opening by now. I don't see it.
Or even if we were going to have a big financial collapse, that would seem like the end of the world.
Well, there was that earthquake off the coast of Japan a few days ago. That could be the beginning.
Oh, you're right. There was. There was. I feel sorry for those people in Japan.
Yeah.
My God. Well, I guess we should get moving along so that we... don't end up not having enough time. So we are at chapter... I just moved my thing and I lost my, no, I'm right here. We are at chapter 20, which is the concluding chapter of book one of the four books I already said. And it, title of it is what?
So scanning to the next page, Jewish testimony in favor of Bolshevism.
That's right. So last week we had, I was talking about, what the non-Jews said, what the Gentiles said about it. Now he's going to talk about what the Jews say about it and how in favor of Bolshevism they were at that time.
Yeah. Okay, well, it starts with this lengthy quote from the American Hebrew. Out of the economic chaos, the discontent of the Jew evolved organized capital with its working instrumentality, the banking system. One of the impressive phenomena of the impressive time is the revolt of the Jew against the Frankenstein which his own mind conceived and his own hand fashioned. That achievement, Russian Bolshevik Revolution, editor, destined to figure in history as the overshadowing result of the World War, was largely the outcome of Jewish thinking, of Jewish discontent, of Jewish effort to reconstruct. What Jewish idealism and Jewish discontent have so powerfully contributed to accomplish in Russia, the same historic qualities of the Jewish mind and heart are tending to promote in other countries. Shall America, like the Russia of the Tsars, overwhelm the Jews with the bitter and baseless reproach of being a destroyer and thus put him in the position of an irreconcilable enemy? Or shall America avail itself of Jewish genius as it avails itself of the peculiar genius of every other race? That is the question for the American people to answer. From an article in the American Hebrew, September 10th, 1920.
Yeah, okay. They like this article in the American Hebrew, which was written in that year, you know, so it made a big impression on them. Okay, that's the introduction, right?
Yeah. Jewish testimony in favor of Bolshevism. The American people will answer that question, and their answer will be against the disruptive genius of dissatisfied Jews. It is very well known that what Jewish idealism and Jewish discontent have so powerfully contributed to accomplish in Russia is also being attempted in the United States. Why did not the writer in the American Hebrew say the United States instead of saying the same historic qualities of the Jewish mind and heart are tending to promote in other countries? Jewish idealism and Jewish discontent are not directed against capital. Capital is enlisted in their service. The only governmental order the Jewish effort is directed against is Gentile governmental order. And the only capital it attacks is Gentile capital.
Mm-hmm.
Lord Eustace Percy, who, if one may judge by the full and appreciative quotations of his words in the Jewish press, has the sanction of thinkers among the Jews, settles this first point. Discussing the Jewish tendency to revolutionary movements, he says, in Eastern Europe, Bolshevism and Zionism often seem to grow side by side, just as Jewish influence molded Republican and Socialist thought. Throughout the 19th century, down to the Young Turk Revolution in Constantinople hardly more than a decade ago. Not because the Jew cares for the positive side of radical philosophy, not because he desires to be a partaker in Gentile nationalism or Gentile democracy, but because no existing Gentile system of government is ever anything but distasteful to him. And that analysis is absolutely true. In Russia, the excuse was the Tsar. In Germany, the Kaiser. In England, it is the Irish question. In the numerous South American revolutions, where the Jews always had a ruling hand, no particular reason was thought necessary to be given. But in the United States, it is the capitalistic class. But always and everywhere, it is by the confession of their own spokesman, a distaste for any form whatsoever of Gentile government. The Jew believes that the world is his by right. He wants to collect his own, and the speediest way of doing so is the destruction of order by revolution, a destruction which is made possible by a long and clever campaign of loose and destructive ideas. As to the second point, every reader can verify the fact from his own experience. Let him recall to his mind the capitalists who have been held up to public scorn in the Jew-controlled press of the United States. And whom does he find them to be? Whose forms have you seen caricatured with the dollar mark in Hearst's newspapers? Are they Seligman, Kahn, Warburg, Schiff, Kuhn, Loeb and Company, or any of the others? No, these are Jewish bankers. The attack is never made on them. The names made most familiar to you by newspaper denunciation are the names of Gentile industrial and banking leaders. And Gentile leaders only, the principal ones being Morgan and Rockefeller. It is a well-known fact.
They talked about Rockefeller so much.
Oh, yeah.
And they used Rockefeller so much that people started insisting that the Rockefellers were Jews and things like that, you know, to tie it in with Jewish bankers, instead of talking about the Jewish bankers themselves.
Yeah. A lot of these people that talk about the Council on Foreign Relations and all that stuff all the time can't get off the Rockefellers.
True. Yeah, and David Rockefeller, he's like the worst person. Well, and now they say that he doesn't have much power or anything anymore.
Yeah.
You think
well,
so?
You know, Pat Robertson wrote this book called The New World Order. Actually, somebody wrote it for him, but there was this book with his name on it, which I think he ended up distancing himself from. And it says in there that the Rockefellers actually don't know much about their own affairs. They have Jews running everything for them.
Huh, so they're like a typical front organization. Just a real big one.
It is a well-known fact that during the French Commune, when men of wealth suffered severe losses in property, the Jewish Rothschilds were not injured to the extent of one pennyworth. And actually, I've read about that. That was an account given by Moltke the Elder.
Good man.
It is also a well-known fact capable of proof satisfactory to any ordinary mind that the connections between Jewish financiers and the more dangerous revolutionary elements here in the United States are such that it is most unlikely that the former stand to lose anything in any event. Undercover.
Let's go back to this French Commune thing you said you had read about.
Yeah.
At that time, it's known, it's clear that the Rothschilds did not suffer at all from that. Well, are they referring to the French Revolution?
No. This is the Commune, the Paris Commune. From I think it was 1871. It was contemporary with the Franco-Prussian War. And somehow or other, this Prussian Field Marshal Moltke, and there were two of them. There was Moltke the Elder and Moltke his son, who was a Field Marshal in the First World War.
Mm-hmm.
The Field Marshal Moltke somehow or other was aware of what was going on there. And according to him, there were guards in front of the Rothschilds' establishments in Paris while everything else around them was being looted.
Uh-huh. Okay, very good. So yeah, so that's you've documented that, so to speak.
I wasn't really clear when I read the account whether the guards were government guards or, you know, people that the Rothschilds had hired.
Well, in any event, nobody bothered them, huh? It could be. Yeah, it could be they could hire their own. You know, they certainly have the money to do so.
Hmm. Okay. It is also, it is also a well-known fact capable of proof satisfactory to any ordinary mind that the connections between Jewish financiers and the more dangerous revolutionary elements here in the United States are such that it is most unlikely that the former stand to lose anything in any event. Under cover of the disorder in Russia at the present time, Jewish financiers are taking advantage of the stress of the people to gain control of all the strategic natural resources and municipal property by methods which they fully expect to be legalized by Jewish courts when the present Bolshevik regime announces that it will give way to a modified communism. I don't think that ever actually happened. The world hasn't seen the end of Bolshevism yet. Like the World War, Bolshevism cannot be interpreted until it is seen who profits most by it. And the profiteering is in full sway now. The enemy is Gentile capital, not any other. And all the wealth of the world in our hands is the unspoken slogan of every Jewish outbreak in the world today. The quotation at the head of this article represents the position which the Jews are now ready to take with reference to the Russian Revolution. They have always been charged with responsibility for what has occurred in that unhappy country, but at first their spokesman denied it. The denials were most indignant and were usually accompanied by the typical plaint that the charge was persecution. But the facts have been so overwhelming and the government investigations have been so revealing that denials have been abandoned. For a while, an attempt was made to distract attention from Russia by a tremendously powerful propaganda concerning the Jews in Poland. There are many indications that the Polish propaganda was undertaken as a cover for the immense immigration of Jews into the United States. It may be that some of our readers do not know it, but an immense stream of the most undesirable immigrants pours daily into the United States. Tens of thousands of the same people whose presence has been the problem and menace of the governments of Europe.
Well, when they say the most undesirable immigrants, they're talking about Jews, and they're talking about Polish Jews who are probably, a lot of them are really Russian Jews. Russian Jews went to Poland, and then they
called
themselves
Poles. It's just a matter of where the border is at the moment.
Yeah, that's true, too. So, you know, and these are the most, you know, I'm glad they point that out, that these are the most undesirable immigrants we could possibly have.
Yes. Oh, yeah, even the New York Times was talking about the Jewish troublemakers at that time. I remember seeing a letter from a rabbi saying, all Jews are not anarchists.
See, and allowing something like this to happen, it doesn't take long. A few years of this, and our country has changed forever. You know, I mean, it's just amazing what is too much is tolerated in democracy. Oh, yeah. And they use that. They push all, they appeal to all this. Oh, you know, America, the land of immigrants, here we come, and so on. And everybody says, well, I guess we better let them in. We're the land of immigrants. Brother.
Well, that land of immigrants thing is not very old. That only goes back to, like, I don't know, 1880s, I think.
Well, that's about when these people
because
were
that's,
coming,
that's, you know, the Jews actually invented that idea, I think.
Oh, they did. They did, and with that poem that they stuck,
yeah,
they
and
managed
Lazarus.
To get stuck
and actually,
on
you know,
the
that,
Statue of Liberty.
Yeah, and the reason why that's on there is because erecting the Statue of Liberty and getting a base for it to put it on was all left in private hands. It was all left in private hands to do that. The government didn't do that. And because it was left in private hands, the Jews took over. And they did it their way. And they put their Jewish poem on there.
Yeah, somehow they got it. They got it on there. They had a, what do you call it? They had a thing where everybody turned in poems. Contests of some kind. And they published them all and everything, and then they picked this woman's poem to win and put it on there. And it shouldn't be there. It should be removed.
Yeah.
As soon as possible, it should be removed.
It's not even a statue of a woman anyway. It's a statue of, if you read, Apuleius, the Golden Ass, there's a description in the last chapter of the Golden Ass of a man dressed up like that. He's dressed up as Helios. Anyway.
Well, maybe he's supposed to be a sexless person. Simba.
Well, there ain't no boobies on that statue, and in that clinging drapery style, they always put the boobies in. Anyway.
Well, I'll have to check that out.
Yeah.
To look at that.
Well, the Polish propaganda and the immigration movement are sailing along smoothly, and the United States government is assured by the Jewish ring at Washington that everything is quiet along the Potomac. It is quiet there, quiet as the Jewish ring could wish. But still, the Russian fact persists in calling for explanation. And here is the explanation. The Jews created capitalism, we are told, but capitalism has proved itself ill-behaved. So now, the Jewish creators are going to destroy their creation. They have done so in Russia. And now, will the American people be good and let their Jewish benefactors do the same in America? That is the new explanation. And typically Jewish again, it is coupled with a proposal for the United States and a threat. If America refuses this particular service of the Jew, we put him in the position of an irreconcilable enemy. See quotation at the head of this article. But the Jews have not destroyed capitalism in Russia. When Lenin and Trotsky make their farewell bow and retire under the protective influence of the Jewish capitalists of the world, it will be seen that only Gentile or Russian capital has been destroyed, and that Jewish capital has been enthroned.
They couldn't have foreseen then that there wasn't going to be much more time left for Lenin and Trotsky.
Yeah.
Was there? They were.
Well, I think Trotsky lasted until the 1940s before he had a pickaxe stuck into his skull.
40s? That long? Oh, that's right. Well, he was in South America or something.
Mexico, I believe.
Yeah. But he wasn't in Russia. He was finished in Russia, but that's true. Yeah.
What is the record? Documents printed by the United States government contain this letter. Please note the date, the Jewish banker, and the Jewish names. Stockholm, September 21st, 1917. To Mr. Raphael Scholan. Dear comrade, the banking house M. Warburg opened an account for the enterprise of Comrade Trotsky upon receipt of a telegram from the chairman of the Rhine-Westphalian Syndicate. A lawyer, probably Mr. Kestroff, obtained ammunition and organized the transportation of same, together with that of the money, to whom the sum demanded by Comrade Trotsky is to be handed. Fraternal greetings, Fürstenberg.
Now, I have to ask about this, because is this accepted as authentic? Because this is pretty wild, you know, pretty amazing. I mean, everything is named there, but it says documents printed by the United States government. Well, that lots of things could be printed by the United States government, I guess.
This was printed in a booklet called The German Bolshevik Conspiracy, that was published by the Committee on Public Information, which was part of the United States government during the First World War. And it was directed by George Creel. And some people say that this is probably not reliable, but I don't think anybody's ever demonstrated any reason to disbelieve it. Obviously, you should always be distrustful of war propaganda. But fabricating an actual telegram seems a little beyond what the war propaganda usually does. And I've never seen any debunking of it. I actually got the link or the lead about where this came from French Wikipedia.
Ah.
French Wikipedia, the article on Jacob Schiff has a reference to this.
Well, what is the Rhine-Westphalian Syndicate? Is that
it's
a real
obviously
thing?
Some kind of banking syndicate, you know.
So they got Warburg opening an account for Trotsky, Comrade Trotsky.
I'm guessing, actually. I mean, I don't know. But it's not really too relevant. But what it says is that Warburg was involved
funded.
in this Warburg. I mean, there were Warburgs in Germany and Warburgs in the USA.
Oh, yeah. And Max Warburg, right?
Yeah, I guess.
Is that M? That's the United States, right?
Not sure. Anyway, it shows Jews sending money to Trotsky, Jewish bankers.
Yeah.
And that supports the idea of bankers and Bolsheviks working together.
Yeah.
And he actually gives a little explanation after this where he talks about, although this Max Warburg was in Germany, they weren't getting money only from Germany. And he talks about the fact that Kuhn Loeb had sent money to for fomenting socialist revolution during the Russo-Japanese War. Also.
Right. Right. Were you going to read that?
That's a corroboration. Long before that, an American Jewish financier was supplying the funds which carried revolutionary propaganda to thousands of Russian prisoners of war in Japanese camps.
Yeah, I mean Jacob Schiff. Right? That's what they're talking about.
Yeah. It is sometimes said by way of explaining the Bolshevik movement that it was financed from Germany, a fact which was seized upon to supply war propaganda. It is true that part of the money came from Germany. It is true that part of the money came from the United States. It is the whole truth that Jewish finance in all the countries was interested in Bolshevism as an all-Jewish movement or investment.
Mm-hmm.
For the whole period of the war, the Jewish world program was cloaked under this or that national name, the blame being laid on the Germans by the Allies and on the Allies by the Germans, and the people kept in ignorance of who the real personages were.
Meaning that they were Jews.
Yeah.
Once again, yeah.
Well, you know, a lot of those Jewish names are linguistically German.
That's right.
Most people wouldn't realize that Fürstenberg might not be a German. It was stated by a French official that 2 million of money was contributed by one Jewish banker alone. When Trotsky left the United States to fulfill his appointed task, he was released from arrest at Halifax, Nova Scotia, upon the request of the United States. And everyone knows who constituted the war government of the United States.
Now, I think that's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Not that it's the first time I've heard that, but, you know, things like this. The United States released him from arrest so that he could continue on. I guess maybe they could say, well, we wanted to get rid of him so he could go on to Russia. But anyway, still.
The conclusion, when all the facts are considered, is irresistible that the Bolshevik Revolution was a carefully groomed investment on the part of international Jewish finance.
Well, there again, you know, I have that really emphasized here because there's this flat out statement that the Bolshevik Revolution was an investment of international Jewish finance. And they were behind it. Of course, this is just the international Jew saying this, but a lot of people, you know, I mean, how much would you say that this is the general consensus today?
The general consensus?
Yeah. Even among PC people.
I don't think very many people think about that.
Well, maybe they don't think about it.
They probably have a better recollection of Jews. Poor Jews trying to leave the Soviet Union to go to Israel and not being allowed.
Well, that's why we need to spend more time bringing all these facts out and talking about all these things to the general public. Okay.
It is easy to understand, then, why the same forces would like to introduce it to the United States. The real struggle in this country is not between labor and capital. The real struggle is between Jewish capital and Gentile capital, with the IWW leaders, the socialist leaders, the red leaders, and the labor leaders, almost a unit on the side of the Jewish capitalists. Again, recall which financiers these men most attack. You cannot recall a single Jewish name. The main purpose in these two articles, however, is to introduce the Jewish testimony which exists as to the Jewish nature of Bolshevism. The Jewish Chronicle of London said in 1919, "There is much in the fact of Bolshevism itself, in the fact that so many Jews are Bolsheviks, in the fact that the ideals of Bolshevism at many points are consonant with the finest ideals of Judaism." In the same paper of 1920 is a report of an address made by Israel Zangwill, a noted Jewish writer, in which he pronounced glowing praise on the race which has produced a Beaconsfield, a Redding, a Montague, a Klotz, a Kurt Eisner, a Trotsky.
It was Israel Zangwill an American Jew?
I don't think so.
Where did he live?
I have no idea. I suspect he lived in Germany, but I've no idea really.
Yeah, well, I think I have to look that up. But I don't think he talked that way though.
All right. Mr. Zay, well, when you find out where he's from, I'll make a note of it.
Well, you know, he's famous. I've even written about him, but I can't think of exactly what his nationality is.
Well, you know, if you hear, like, if you hear Jews in some German movie talk in Yiddish, it kind of sounds like that, actually. I mean, if you could do German with that accent.
If they're talking Yiddish, I suppose.
Yeah. Kind of sounds like German with that accent inflicted on it.
Okay.
Mr. Zangwill, in his swelling Semitic enthusiasm, embraced the Jews in the British government in the same category with the Jews of the Hungarian and Russian Bolshevik governments. What is the difference? They're all Jewish and all of equal honor and usefulness to the race.
Yeah, so, you know, he's praising people like Beaconsfield, who I suppose is a Jew with a
reputation
or something. Oh, that's
Beaconsfield is Disraeli.
Oh, okay, that's good information. I didn't know that. And you know, Montague and these, you know, respected people, and he's mixing them together with Kurt Eisner and Trotsky.
Yeah,
these revolutionaries. Yeah.
Rabbi J. L. Magnus, in an address at New York in 1919, is reported to have said. Can I do this?
Yes.
When the Jew gives his thought, his devotion to the cause of the workers and of the dispossessed, of the disinherited of the world, the radical quality within him goes to the roots of things. And in Germany, he becomes a Marx and a LaSalle, a Haas, and an Edward Bernstein. In Austria, he becomes a Victor Adler and a Friedrich Adler. In Russia, a Trotsky. Just take for a moment the present situation in Russia and in Germany. The revolution set creative forces free, and see what a large company of Jews was available for immediate service. Socialist revolutionaries and Mensheviki and Bolsheviki, majority and minority socialists, whatever they be called, Jews are to be found among the trusted leaders and the routine workers of all these revolutionary parties.
Well, there you go. You know, and they actually will honor Marx and of course Trotsky and whoever these other people. But whatever Jews are doing, they have decided, I think, by this time that they will stand behind them. They won't criticize them or call them, you know, evil people. Are they still doing that? Would you say that's their method of operation now? That everything that Jews have done can be explained in a positive way?
Well, they always promote their own, that's for sure.
Well, they do.
They made Einstein the symbol of genius, even though he really didn't do that much.
Oh, that's a thing that's really irritating. That's so irritating. It shows how they can do with the power of the press. You know, and they got that early on. They knew. Why didn't the rest of us know? I don't know. We're not looking. We're not, because we weren't planning and scheming to take over the world.
See, says the rabbi, what a large company of Jews are available for immediate service. One ought to see where he points. There are as many Jewish members of revolutionary societies in the United States as there were in Russia, and here, as there, they are available for immediate service. Bernard Lazar, a Jewish writer who has published a work on anti-Semitism, says, "The Jew, therefore, does take a part in revolutions, and he participates in them insofar as he is a Jew, or, more correctly, insofar as he remains a Jew." He says also, "The Jewish revolutionary spirit is essentially the Jewish spirit is essentially a revolutionary spirit. And consciously or otherwise, the Jew is a revolutionist."
Is that where E. Michael Jones got his title of his book?
I was thinking that. Yeah, I would suspect so.
Or this might not be the only place where the Jewish spirit is called a revolutionary spirit. But Bernard Lazar, he's pretty well known. Do you know, can you say anything about him? Can you place him exactly?
Well, I mean, I read the... When I was trying to get some context for some of the claims made in Ford's International Jew, that was one of the sources that I found that made some comments. You could read his, I forget what his booklet is called. It's like The Role of the Jew in World Conspiracy or something similar to that. And he actually does admit quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he says things like, you know, well, yeah, okay, so there were a lot of Jews leading the Bolsheviks, but they're not real Jews, you know, that kind of stuff.
Oh.
That kind of stuff. There is hardly any country in the world except the United States where denials of this could be made in such a way as to require proof. In every other country, the fact is known. Here we have been under such a fear of mentioning the word Jew or anything pertaining to it that the commonest facts have been kept from us, facts which even a superficial knowledge of Jewish writing would have given us. It was almost a pathetic spectacle to see American audiences go to lectures about the Russian situation and come away from the hall confused and perplexed because the Russian situation is so un-Russian. All because no lecturer thought it politic to mention Jew in the United States. For as someday we shall see, the Jew has contrived to gain control of the platform too.
Now this is very important. And you know, this brings up that motto that Don came up with. Break the taboo, criticize the Jew. See, now we're talking here about that taboo and how because of it, nobody understands what's going on, and people went to these lectures about what was going on in Russia, and they couldn't understand why the Russians were behaving this way, because nobody would say Jew. We've got to stop that, and it's even the same today.
Yeah. They've actually expanded that syndrome now. They'll give reports on violent crimes, and they'll say what the perpetrator was wearing, but they won't say what his race was.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's right, the violent crime with the race
and
so on.
This is outrageous. I first noticed that in a college newspaper in the 1990s. I thought, this is just incredible. What the hell is this?
If race isn't real, why mention it?
How is this supposed to be useful? How are they going to catch somebody from a newspaper article that talks about what somebody was wearing the previous day? That's absurd.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that shows the absurdity of being under the rule of Jews, and how people, you know, all this stuff needs to be pointed out by many, many people. And here we have all these people who are, you know, a part of our people who don't want to talk about the Jew either. They're, you know, it's no fun doing that for them.
Yeah, Jews definitely do have some influence over schools of journalism, I'm sure. Not only do the literary lights of Jewry acknowledge the Jew's propensity to revolution generally and his responsibility for the Russian situation particularly, but the lower lights also have a very clear idea about it. The Jew, in the midst of the revolution, is conscious that somehow he is advancing the cause of Israel. He may be a bad Jew in the synagogue sense, but he is enough of a Jew to be willing to do anything that would advance the prestige of Israel. Race is stronger than religion in Jewry.
That's a good line. That's a pretty straight out line, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Russian paper.
They were making, you know, that was probably quite bold at that time to make a statement like that.
Maybe.
But they made it, and they're talking about race there.
Well, a lot of people in that period were talking about race. You know, Madison Grant, his book, The Passing of the Great Race, had only been out a couple of years when this was published.
Yeah, well, it's true. Probably race is less popular, less possible to talk about today than it was then.
Yeah. The whole biological worldview was coming into vogue in the 1920s. And then, you know, around 1930, when, you know, shortly after when Roosevelt came in, that it fell into disfavor. The Rush, I mean, you had that feminist, Sanger, you know, she was advocating eugenics.
Margaret
and so
Sanger,
forth.
Yeah.
In the 1920s, and then in the 30s, she totally flip-flopped.
Well, the communists took control in this country.
Well, the intellectual fashion changed. The Russian paper On to Moscow in September 1919 said, "It should not be forgotten that the Jewish people, who for centuries were oppressed by kings and czars, are the real proletariat, the real international, which has no country." Mr. Cohen, in the newspaper Communist, in April 1919, said, "Without exaggeration, it may be said that the great Russian social revolution was indeed accomplished by the hands of Jews. Would the dark, oppressed masses of the Russian workmen and peasants have been able to throw off the yoke of the bourgeoisie by themselves? No, it was precisely the Jews who led the Russian proletariat to the dawn of the international, and not only have led, but are also now leading the Soviet cause, which remains in their safe hands. We may be quiet as long as the chief command of the Red Army is in the hands of Comrade Leon Trotsky. It is true that there are no Jews in the ranks of the Red Army as far as privates are concerned, but in the committees and Soviet organizations as commissars, the Jews are gallantly leading the masses of the Russian proletariat to victory. It is not without reason that during the elections to all Soviet institutions, the Jews are winning by an overwhelming majority. The symbol of Jewry, which for centuries has struggled against capitalism, has become also the symbol of the Russian proletariat, which can be seen even in the adoption of the red five-pointed star, which in former times, as it is well known, was the symbol of Zionism and Jewry. With this sign comes victory. With this sign comes the death of the parasites of the bourgeoisie. Jewish tears will come out of them in sweat of drops of blood."
Well, okay, you know, then they're going to go on into this.
Yeah. The Communist.
Yeah, he's a communist, so, you know, naturally, he says all this stuff. But, you know, I think they're going to talk some more here about the star, and I find that a little far-fetched.
Yes, I did, too.
This whole simple idea about how the five-pointed star and is connected to the six-pointed star.
Yeah, I didn't find that convincing at all. Mm-hmm. This confession, or rather boast, is remarkable for its completeness. "The Jew," says Mr. Cohen, "are in control of the Russian masses, the Russian masses who have never risen at all, who only know that a minority, like the Tsar's minority, is in control at the seat of government. The Jews are not in the Red Army," Mr. Cohen informs us, "that is, in the ranks where the actual fighting is done,
and this is strictly in line with the protocols. The strategy of the world program is to set Gentiles to kill Gentiles. This was the Jewish boast during various French social disasters that so many Frenchmen had been set killing each other. Well, you know, there were Jewish officers in the Red Army above the rank of private, actually. Some of them were captured during Second World War, anyway. As far as the Red Army at this time, which was still struggling to take over Russia against the White Army, they did have a lot of poor non-Jews fighting for them, but a lot of them were not Russians. Like, there were a lot of Latvians and other non-Russians that were adherents of the Bolshevik cause.
That were not Jews.
Yeah. That's a major reason why the Bolsheviks came to power, I think, and the Mensheviks did not, is the Bolsheviks had a lot more success in getting non-Jews on their side because they promised, you know, we'll do something about your problems now instead of the Menshevik Orthodox Marxist position of saying, just wait for the historical dialectic to work itself out and then your problems will be solved. That's not a very strong allurement there.
So again, yeah. It's just promising people things that they want, you know, whether you can deliver it or not.
Well, this is really what happens probably very often when there's social turmoil. Somebody promises to cut the Gordian knot and just do whatever it takes to make sure everybody has food on the table, etc. And that's what the Bolsheviki did in this circumstance. Now, if they hadn't done that, then maybe some Russian general would have done it. There was that, there was a Russian general, actually, that was going to take over the government at one point. It was foiled. Anyway.
Well, that's what Obama's doing right now. I mean, you can always be promising things to people. Well, we better go on or we might not finish.
All right. In the World War just passed, there were as many Gentiles killed by Gentiles as there are Jews in the world. It was a great victory for Israel. Jewish tears will come out in sweat of drops of blood. But the Jews are in the places of control and safety, says Mr. Cohen, and he is absolutely right about it. The wonder is that he was so honest as to say it. As to the elections, so-called, at which the Jews are so unanimously chosen, the literature of Bolshevism is very explicit. Those who voted against the Jewish candidates were judged enemies of the revolution and executed. It did not require many executions at a voting place to make all the elections unanimous. Mr. Cohen is especially instructive on the significance of the Red Star, the five-pointed emblem of Bolshevism, the symbol of Jewry, he says, has become also the symbol of the Russian proletariat. The Star of David, the Jewish national emblem, is a six-pointed star formed by two triangles, one standing on its base, the other on its apex. Deprived of their baselines, these triangles approximate the familiar Masonic emblem of the square and compass. It is the star, is this Star of David, of which a Jewish observer in Palestine remarks that there are so few among the graves of the British soldiers who won Palestine in the recent war. Most of the signs are the familiar wooden cross.
Well, this is all interesting, but you know, how does a square, it says, how does a triangle, approximate the square
we've got the
Masons. I can see the other one.
You've seen that Masonic compass. Emblem. It has an angle pointed up and an angle pointed down.
Oh, okay. It's the angles. All right.
Yeah.
Well, I can see the one part of it, but I can't visualize the other, so I have to take a look.
Yeah. I mean, it almost looks like that the double triangles, but
also interesting in that they talk about the you know, in Palestine, I had to look that up there, but, you know, it was a part of the Ottoman Empire still. And the British fought and won it over. And it was British soldiers who won Palestine, is what they're saying there, not Jews, who then started, you know, lobbying for being able to get it from for the British giving it to them, mm-hmm. basically.
Yeah, anyway, those symbols don't really come from Judaism. They come from, well, the Pythagoreans used them. And
Right.
A lot of people use those symbols.
That's right.
You know, they picked them up and included them in their Kabbalah. These crosses are now reported to be objectionable to the new rulers of Palestine because they are so plainly in view of the visitor who approaches the new Jewish university. As in Soviet Russia, so in Palestine, not many Jews laid down their lives for the cause. There were plenty of Gentiles for that purpose.
Yeah, so they have this cemetery with all these crosses, and now the Jews don't like that being there because it shows that Palestine was won from the Turks by the British, not by the Jews. Well, they want to change that. They'll probably pull up all those things.
Well, not only that, but they just don't like to see crosses.
That's true too.
You know, vampires can't take that.
They might.
As the Jew is a past master in the art of symbolism, it may not be without significance that the Bolshevik star has 1 point less than the Star of David, for there is still 1 point to be fulfilled in the world program as outlined in the protocols, and that is the enthronement of our leader. When he comes, the world autocrat for whom the whole program is framed, the sixth point may be added. This was nutty to me. The 5 points of the star now apparently assured are the purse, the press, the peerage, Palestine and proletarianism. Oh, it's all P's. The sixth point will be the Prince of Israel. This is nuttiness. It is very hard to say. It is hard to believe, but Mr. Cohen has said it, and revolutions, especially since the French Revolution, confirm it, that with this sign comes the death of the parasites of the bourgeoisie. Jewish tears will come out of them in sweat of drops of blood. The bourgeoisie, as the protocols say, are always Gentile. The common counter-argument to the invincible fact of the Jewish character of the Russian Revolution, an argument which is destined to disappear now that Jewish acknowledgement is coming thick and fast, is that the Jews in Russia suffer too. How can we favor a movement which makes our own people suffer? Is the argument put up to the Gentile. Well, the fact is this. They are favoring that movement. Today, this very movement, the Bolshevik government, is receiving money from Jewish financiers in Europe. And if in Europe, then of course from the international Jewish bankers in the United States also. That is one fact. Another fact is this. The Jews of Russia are not suffering to anywhere near the extent we are told by the propagandists. It is now a fact admitted by Jews themselves that upon the first sweep of the Bolshevists across Europe,
Poland.
The Polish Jews were friendly.
Across Poland. Did you
across
say
Poland,
Europe?
Excuse me. Across Poland, because they had a war around that time. The Polish Jews were friendly with the invaders and helped them. The fact was explained by American Jews in this manner. Since Bolshevism came to Russia, the condition of the Jews there has greatly improved. Therefore, the Polish Jews were friendly. And it is true, the condition of Russian Jews is good. One reason, they have Russia. Everything there belongs to them. The other reason is the Jews of Russia are the only ones receiving help there today. Did that second statement ever strike you as significant? Only the Jews of Russia have food and money sent to them. It is one form, of course, of the support which the Jewish world is giving Bolshevism. But if the suffering among the Jews is what the propagandists say it is, what must it be among the Russians? Yet no one is sending food or money to them. The probable truth of the whole situation is that Jewish Bolshevism is laying a tax on the world. Any time it may be required, there is plenty of evidence as to the good condition of the Jews in Russia. They have all there is. Another source of confusion is revealed in the question, how can Jewish capitalists support Bolshevism when Bolshevism is against capitalism?
Bolshevism, as before stated, is only against Gentile capitalism. Jewish financiers who remained in Russia are very useful to the Bolsheviki. Read this description by an eyewitness. A Jew in this commissary of the bank, very elegant, with a cravat of the latest style and a fancy waistcoat. A Jew is this district commissary, former stockbroker with a double bourgeois chin. Again, a Jew, this inspector of taxes. He understands perfectly how to squeeze the bourgeoisie.
Hattie, let's skip these next couple of paragraphs because we're almost out of time and go to these points. One is, it has taken a whole rich country without the cost of war. This is what the Red Revolution, what the Jews have managed to do. As they sort of, I don't know, this is what they're teaching us. So what about number 2, 3, and 4? It has demonstrated the necessity of gold. It has demonstrated its power in the world. And then it has, not the least, is the field practice in the art of revolution, which it has gained. So it's saying that these techniques of revolution have been reduced to a science now, according to the details laid down in the protocols. I'm sorry to take over here, but I realize we're about out of time. So what do you want to say about these last paragraphs?
Well, you talk about, I found this particularly interesting here. This says, if the Bolshevists had been honest, they could have dealt Jewish capitalism its death blow. No, gold is still on its throne. Destroy the fiction that gold has value, and you leave the Jewish international financiers sitting forlorn on the heaps of useless metal. And that's what Hitler did. He set up an economy and a currency that was not based in any way on gold. And he also circumvented the need to have a currency that was exchangeable for gold in international trade by using a barter system. And some people, I think Churchill said it, some people think that this is the real reason why the National Socialist Germany had to be destroyed.
Well, yeah, I think that's pretty well accepted by people in the know, that it was all financial. You know, it's because what Germany was representing, freedom from Jewish banking debt and so on. And so there we are, and we're still under this belief in gold as the real value of the world rather than paper money. It's really wrong. It's taken me a long time to see that.
Labor is the real backing of money.
Right.
Because you give the government issues money to somebody in exchange for work. Right?
Yeah, and if you destroy the population through dumbing them down and making them weak and sick and so on, is what's happening to us, to the white race, then their labor, then they don't have that power of their labor and so on. And they're really defeated. We are really defeated. So, well, that's the end of book one and the end of this chapter, ladies and gentlemen, the end of this program. We'll see you next week. We'll be here. I hope you'll be here with us. Good night.
Bye.
Thanks for listening. The International Jew Study Hour will return next week, exclusively on the White Network.